Well, thanks very much, and that's a great segue. I'm actually going to talk about bats because we're just a few days after Halloween. I think it's appropriate. And as I was getting my talk together, I realised there are so many of these bat viruses going. What is going on with the world? So I'm going to try and answer some of those questions. And Lonnie asked me to talk about studies at the interface between humans and animals, and I think bats are as good a place to start as any. So I'm going to go back to the SARS outbreak, and thanks for setting that up. If you look at what happened in the beginning of SARS and look at really the first clusters of cases, and we're now a decade on from SARS, by the way, so it's a timely reminder. If you look at that first column on the left, January 2003, the highest percentage of the proportion of cases are people who work in the food industry, either in restaurants or supplying those restaurants. Now, the place where this first emerged was Guangdong province, southern China. And if you go to there, you see this is what we're talking about. This is the food industry in Guangdong. That's actually a cat. And this is from the market where SARS first emerged. It's a wholesale market. People live in the marketplace. They have children in the marketplace. You'll go into one store, you'll see the kid is sat there watching TV. There's a bed here, and there are cages of different animals here, and there's bits of animals all over the place. So it's a very unsanitary place, but it's a huge cultural significance to local people. And these wildlife that they eat are highly desirable products. Now, you mentioned civets just in the last talk, and what happened was when SARS first emerged, a group went into one of the markets where the first cluster of cases started and found that civets, which are sort of ferret, badger-type animal, had SARS virus, very closely related to human, but essentially human SARS. But there was something odd about it. I think 8 out of 12 were positive for the virus. They had infections right there and then. Now, in a normal wildlife host, you would expect just a few animals to be positive, you know, 3 or 4%, and a lot of animals to have antibodies to SARS because it's a natural part of their natural history. In this case, most of the animals had the virus and none had antibodies. So although this was a big splash at the time, we thought, well, something odd's going on. A group of us, including veterinarians, ecologists, virologists, got together and working with support from CSIRO Australia and World Health Organization, went back out to China and started to look at this. And what we found was we tested a lot of animals from the markets where SARS emerged. And this is a cute little kid barefoot in the markets, and he's fascinated by these bats that are in a cage there. And bats are eaten all across Asia. They're a great source of protein if you catch them. It's free food. And if you go into a cave, there are millions of them. So that's millions of free little bits of protein. So they're widely eaten and also have great cultural significance. They're good for your health, allegedly. What we found out was actually bats are bad for your health. And what we found was, if you look halfway down, Rhinolophus ferrumequinum, we found, at Rhinolophus macrotis, we found 71%, 33% positive for SARS antibodies, and then we managed to show PCR sequence of a SARS-like virus from these bats. When we looked at the relationship of those viruses to SARS, the SARS viruses are SZ3, TOR2, and GD01. All the others are these bat viruses. So SARS emerged from within this group of bat viruses. And what we think happened is that civets were also infected in the markets where these bats were. So they're a sort of innocent bystander. The real culprit here is bats. What I'm going to show you is the real culprit is us. It's what we do to bats that is the driver of the problem. So we were very happy with this. We published a paper in Science. It was a great result. And now 10 years on, where are we? Well, one problem we found was that these viruses actually are incapable of directly infecting people. They don't lock onto the receptor for SARS. So there was clearly a problem with this. Even though it looks like SARS emerged from this group, we estimated that it might take 100 mutations for one of these viruses to infect people. So is it something about the markets, these wildlife markets or the wildlife trade, that allows lots of animals to come together and a virus to start infecting different animals and evolving rapidly so it can get into people? And we started doing surveillance, and lots of groups are now working on these coronaviruses. And this is just, in 2007, the known virus coronaviruses from bats. And now there are probably double that, and there are just a lot of them, a huge diversity. And still none, up until this week actually, none had been found that could directly infect people. So that's SARS, and now we've got MERS. It sounds the similar, and it is very. It sounds the same. It is very similar. This is a respiratory infection, Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome. Right now, as of today, or a couple of days ago, 149 cases, 63 deaths, and it's still out there. It's still moving, probably from person to person at a very low level, which gives it an opportunity to evolve. And it's a coronavirus. When you look at a phylogeny of that coronavirus, it again lines up next to bat coronaviruses. So the question a few weeks ago is this a bat virus, or is it something that involves other wildlife or other species out there? So again, following from the last speaker, we set up collaborations, and now we've got bat biologists that we're working with. Well, are there any bats in Saudi Arabia? I didn't think there could be many. I imagine it to be very dry and miserable, and bats like nice, moist caves, etc. Well, it turns out there's quite a high diversity of bats in Saudi Arabia, in different parts of it. In the very hot, deserty bits, there aren't many. But in some of the places where SARS emerged, there's quite a high diversity of bat species. So our team went out there. We managed to get invited out by the Ministry of Health to look at potential wildlife reservoir. We went to one of the index cases and sampled bats very close to the index case's house. He also kept camels. We sampled those and didn't find any yet. And one question straight away is, what is the animal-human interface for bats in Saudi Arabia? Well, this gives you an example. This is a house that our team went into. There are bats in the roof on the top right, hanging over. This is a fecal-oral contamination virus. It's excreted with feces, so it'd be very easy to get infected if you breathe in a bit of bat fecal dust, just like hantavirus pulmonary syndrome perhaps. And sure enough, after a lot of searching, we managed to find a fragment of virus from a sequence from one bat species that was not only close to MERS but actually 100% identical to human MERS. So this is the first indication, and published it just a few weeks ago now, that bats probably are the reservoir of MERS. So that begs the question, what is wrong with the world on this close to Halloween day that bats carry all these viruses and that we're getting infected by them? So let's go back and look, as Lonnie sort of mentioned earlier on, let's sort of think about what's going on with emerging diseases and why this is a growing and an important problem. So our group pulled together a team, and this time we worked with biologists who were used to handling big data sets and looking at trends in biodiversity and endangered species and what drives extinction, to try and understand what's going on with emerging diseases. We built a database of every known emerging disease from the literature. It's about 450 of them, and this is where the literature says they first emerged. So this is biased because it's also a plot of where people are looking for them, because they're going to find more. So we had to correct for that, and we did this by looking at a standard measure, which is to look at where are articles published on infectious diseases. So that's a rough estimate of surveillance effort. So this corrects for where people are looking for emerging diseases. We then tried to correlate what things correlate with the origin of a new emerging disease. Is it related to where wildlife are? Because many of these are zoonotic. Is it related to where people are doing things to the environment? And just in general, what is the trend in emerging diseases? Are they really as big a threat as we believe they are? So this is just plotting the data over time, decade by decade. So one thing straight away, they're on the rise. And when you correct for the number of researchers increasing over time, emerging diseases are very significantly rising year by year. And you can comfortably predict there'll be around 5 new emerging diseases a year. 3 of those will be zoonotic. So this one health issue is critical for emerging diseases. And the yellow segment of those bars are zoonoses from wildlife. And they're increasing disproportionately. So they are becoming even more significant as a threat, a pandemic threat. Looking at the correlation, the strong correlation was with human population and the things we do on the planet and with wildlife diversity. So the hotspots where diseases should emerge are areas with high wildlife diversity where people are doing a lot of things to the environment, like in China, where there's still a lot of wildlife left and it's being traded across Asia through this market system. So it gives us a way of looking at where we should go and do surveillance. And John Amazat's going to talk a bit about the PREDICT program that targets areas within these hotspots. We also looked at which animals seem to share viruses more easily with people. And it's very common sense that the ones that are most closely related to us should be able to share their pathogens with us more easily. So it turns out to be supported by the analyses we've done. And in fact, the most significant groups are bats, rodents, and primates. So this gives you a hint of why bat viruses are a big deal. It's because there are a lot of bats out there, as many bat species as rodents. We're butting up against their habitat continually. We're eating them. We're moving them on. We're building houses right next to bat caves. We're going into caves. And they are closely related to us. So they share viruses very easily. We've just produced a bat hotspot map. So if you want to know where the next bat virus is most likely to come from, it doesn't reflect just where bats are. It's a reflection of where people are, where rainfall is the highest, and where bushmeat consumption and land use change. And that correlates with pig and sheep density here. So it's, again, areas on the planet where there are a lot of people doing a lot of things like eating wildlife and making changes to the environment. But this is useful to start looking at where other coronaviruses might be. But you know, you can't just go out there and look for new viruses, because we know you're going to find a lot of them. You need to, and it's going to cost a lot of money too. There may be tens of millions of new viruses. So there are some big challenges. We don't know the number of unknown viruses in wildlife. We don't know how our contact with them changes across a landscape or from one country to the next. And we don't know how likely any new virus will be of infecting us. So I just want to talk a little bit about how we can get around these. And as always, I go to my great sage, which is Donald Rumsfeld, who had this fantastic quote. And if you really, you know, it gets mocked a lot, and he won a foot in the mouth award for this, which is a shame because it's actually a touch of genius. A great public speaker, and he got it just right for viral discovery. He said, "There are no knowns, things that we know. There are unknown unknowns." That is to say, there are things that we know we don't know. Now, we know there are a lot of coronaviruses out there in bats. We know that some of those are closely related to SARS. So they're a key target for us. There are also completely unknown unknowns. There are things we do not know we don't know. Genius. Let's not go after the viruses where we know nothing about. Let's target the ones where we know something about them that are unknown. And first of all, how many are there? So we started to take this challenge seriously and using a standard procedure that biologists use for, say, looking at a patch of forest and seeing how many tigers there are out there. You do repeated surveillance, you tag the tiger when you catch it, you release it, and you count the number of times you recapture them. And eventually you find that you're not discovering so many new ones and the discovery curve saturates. So you're getting close to the actual number of tigers. There are always going to be some out there that are very low, very good at hiding that you won't discover. So we did this for viruses. We got 2,000 samples from a bat species in Bangladesh, and we did viral discovery, deep sequencing, and PCR tests for 9 different viral families and looked at how many viruses we could discover. And we found about 5 coronaviruses. So if you're thinking about future SARS threats, this gives you an idea of how many unknown coronaviruses there might be. And using the same statistical analyses that biologists use for tigers, we came up with a figure of about 58 unknown viruses in this bat species. That's roughly equivalent of about 320,000 unknown viruses in all mammals. So this gives you an idea now of, actually, there is an achievable number of unknown viruses. We could go out and discover those over time. For bats alone, there are about 72,000. It's a lot, but it's not tens of millions. In fact, we know that there are 530 total known bat viruses. new ones being discovered each year. The pace of discovery is accelerating. So it's 7% of the total now, but we're on the right track. We even worked out the figures, and I gave a talk at the White House and made sure I mentioned how much it would cost. And I saw one of the aides writing it down. So maybe there'll be a check in the post. I doubt it. But to discover 100% of all unknown mammalian viruses will cost $6.8 billion. It's a lot of money. But because it's a saturating exponential curve, if you discover 85% of them, it's a lot less cost, $1.4 billion. The cost of an outbreak is huge. It's $10 to $50 billion for SARS, maybe more for future pandemic flu, estimates of $300 billion. These are big events, albeit that they're rare. So that's one of the issues, how many unknown viruses there are. What about how our contact varies across the landscape? Well, under the PREDICT program that John is going to talk about, we've set up some study sites where we can look at how human contact with wildlife varies from an urban area through the peri-urban region that Lonnie talked about into the wilderness where people go out and hunt wildlife. And we've set up a standardised way to do surveillance and viral testing at three different sites in difficult-to-work-in locations. So hopefully we'll start to get a handle on that. But I just want to mention one really exciting discovery, the idea of how do you work out whether a new virus is likely to be a threat or not? It's a real challenge. So this gives you an idea of it. We started to go back to China and look for other coronaviruses in bats that are related to SARS. And we just found dozens of them. And this is a paper that is actually in this week's Nature. And luckily, we managed to find a group that were even closer to SARS than our previous ones. The previous ones are in green, the new ones are in blue, and the true SARS and the civet SARS are at the top. So the group that are close to the civet SARS there are actually able to use the human receptor that binds to SARS coronaviruses. So we know now that bats are the true reservoir of SARS, but there are also bats out there that carry viruses that could directly infect us, that don't need civets, that don't need a marketplace. So the interface for human and wildlife transmission of SARS is much bigger than we thought it was. And if you go to parts of rural China, people live in caves in some areas. They eat bats across China. They live next to bat colonies. Tourists visit bats by the droves. I visit bat caves. I visit bat caves when I'm in China and breathe in very lightly. But, you know, some of these bat caves are religious sites too. So this is a big issue, and it's something we can target, though. And I think if we look at the binding receptor binding domains of viruses that we discover, we may be able to move towards predicting which ones could be a risk. So just to finish off on a positive note, how do you deal with this as an issue globally? The wildlife trade that you just mentioned is bringing in giant Gambian jumping rats from Africa, and people get very emotional about the pets. But we're trying to deal with that as a non-profit. And this is Mr. Wei, who runs a farm where he farms wildlife. He's a very intelligent guy. He runs a trade group for wildlife farmers in China. He understands disease risk, and he's concerned about it. He's concerned because when there's a report of a disease in his animals, he can't sell his animals. It's an economic impact. So talking to him about alternatives that are less likely to be poo-pooed by the buyers in the markets is a good way to try to start to shift from the very high-risk species that other people are trading in. And this is what we're looking at. This is a cane rat that he breeds and sells and is very profitable and carries a far lower number of unknown viruses than bats. We're also looking at the sort of ethical side of the wildlife trade and trying to play to people's emotions. And this is an ad we've got up in airports across the US, just trying to say there is an ethical component to wildlife trade that we should try and deal with, and it's not such a nice thing. And finally, the biggest consumer of wildlife on the planet is not China. It's actually us here in the US, and it's for pets, not food. 120 million animals a year come into the US from the wild for pets mainly, and they die and then they're replaced by others. So we've started to work with the pet trade industry group, PJAC, and we've set up a program called Pet Watch that provides alternative choices for people who going into a pet store to buy a wild animal for their kid. And it gives you a choice based on ethics, conservation threat, and health threat. So we're bringing in the pandemic threat into this to say, don't choose a wild caught animal, choose a captive bred animal. So hopefully we'll be able to shift from very high risk to low risk in the future. And I'm going to end there. Thanks very much.